the possibility of having something from India, especially in, you know, present 100%. Times, you know, it's just a very alien concept.
No Pakistanis allowed in capital.
Religion isn't a barrier here. Hmm. It's mullahism that's misinterpreting religion for their control.
They like really shattered our culture.
Islam itself empowers women.
Media's role in that was like pretty awful. Like,
from India's side.
From both sides.
From India's side, let me say that.
Like, no, from both sides.
I feel like you'll never be too much for the right person. It makes sense. And maybe it was a PR stunt from both countries that they... I mean, I don't know what the inside is, but we can only assume. Mm-hmm. But this is what we discussed as well. And it kind of makes sense. I mean, that's a conspiracy theory that I can maybe fall for.
Oh.
Where I didn't even know how to hold a spoon and to like to stir a pot. Mm-hmm. My hand would get tired.
Hi Alishba, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
Thank you so much for having me, Akriti. I have to admit, I'm a bit nervous. This is my first time, but...
I'm also nervous. This is our first time shooting outside India.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm excited that now we've gone international and you are our first guest. So today we're going to be talking about all culture, societal connections that are there between India and Pakistan. And that's why we have you. So first, I want to start with the fact that you are one of the few people from South Asia who get to live the half and half life, because you're half Danish and half Pakistani. And I think this trouble is always there.
Well, allow me to interrupt you there.
Yeah.
I'm not Danish, but I was in a way, I had my education there.
Yeah.
I was born in Islamabad, Pakistan, and then I left Pakistan when I was 14, and then we moved to Denmark.
Mm.
So after that, I studied in Denmark and... so on and so forth.
Yeah, but I think like this trouble is always there, that when at a very young age your parents move from the diaspora that you belong to,
mm-hmm.
I think people are always struggling. So I want to like shed a little light on that. Like what is it like to like be away but still be like in the cool zone?
Mm-hmm.
I want to know everything.
Well, I never had any identity crisis as such, because the household that I was raised in, very ethnic Pashtun household, and growing up we had a very strong emphasis on values, Pukhtun Vali, which in itself is a code of conduct. So we were very confident with that. And even when we moved to Denmark, we, like, when I say we, I mean me and my brothers, we didn't have any issues adjusting, because the sort of education we had, or let's say I was privileged enough to have, was very international. So I consider myself as a global citizen. So we did have some cultural shocks, I'd say. But overall, I never had any issues with identity or who I am, where do I belong? Because I always knew I'm a very nationalist Pukhtun from, Because when you were in Denmark, I was in an IB school, International Baccalaureate, it's what it's called. So there I got to experience many Indians from Bangalore, Delhi. They had identity crisis in a way, because, you know, the places that they come from, and most of them, they even had a thick accent. I might have an accent as well, but I was like, okay, you know, the standard assumption that, or maybe the way people think that, oh, Indians are always talking like with a bob head.
Yeah.
That's what they thought. But that was funny, because some stereotypes are true. For Pakhtuns or Pashtuns, when I was doing my IB, they believed that most Pashtuns, maybe they're Taliban and they have a headscarf on, and how come you're studying abroad, and how do you speak English, and are your parents okay with you studying abroad? And I was like, they're the ones actually encouraging me to have education. Because being Pakhtun, they always link you with Malala Yousafzai, and then they think like, okay, maybe she was the only person to carry that beacon of hope for everyone. But there are a gazillion, a million, billion other Pakhtun women, very empowered. But then again, it comes from a place of privilege, and not everyone has that kind of opportunity. So I just say I was lucky. That's what my father says as well. It's not that you're special, it's just that, you know, God was kind enough to give you an opportunity to get the education that you did, get the exposure that you did, and
And I now want to jump into this fact that I'm really excited about. This entire cultural mix that Indians and Pakistanis have. We don't really talk about it much, and I think we always fear it, at least back home.
Yeah.
And I've noticed, as someone who's lived abroad and also even back at home, I also come from a family that is from an upper middle class. So we are kind of educated in that form, and we hail from Pakistan itself, like before partition.
Yeah.
So we have that mix. And I always think that I relate to people from Pakistan more than I relate to someone who's from South India.
Yeah.
And I point it out, and I feel we never have conversations around this, because we are so scared But yeah, I want to jump into this and see like how similar are our cultures.
Yeah, that's very interesting actually, because most of my friends, they're from Delhi. And then again, because I have so much interaction with these Delhiites, and they told me that we have South Delhi people. And they're called soda, I think. And then you have...
We're not called soda.
Soda, they're like... That's what I was told. So I was like, okay, soda. And it's the same in Islamabad as well. Like, from Pakistan, people are always assuming that, you know, people from Islamabad, they're very burger. And I feel like soda, people from South Delhi are somewhat similar.
I know,
burger. Even with the way we speak or the kind of things that we like, the shows that we watch. And that was very interesting because there was actually no difference at all. South Delhi or whatever were exactly the same. But I did feel a bit out of place with people from Maharashtra, like from Mumbai, and that I couldn't relate with at all. So I was like, okay, because even the Urdu that they speak or the Hindi that they speak, it's very tereko, mereko. And I was like, okay, this is foreign now, because even the Hindi that we hear in Bollywood, it's tum, me, aap, you know, that we can relate to. So the diction was very different with people from Mumbai. That's what I've observed.
Now that you said Bollywood, I also want to know, like, what is the influence of Bollywood that you've had in your life?
Huge.
Who's your favorite actor?
I would say Rajesh Khanna. That's from Dado's time, you know.
Yeah.
God bless her soul. She was obsessed with Bollywood. And growing up, she'd ask me to play songs for her on YouTube. And then I'd search all sorts of songs and movies. And she really liked this movie, what was it called? With Rajesh Khanna again.
Mera Naam Joker.
No, this is a bit contemporary. Yeah. It's a very traditional movie where he used to drink a lot. Pushpa, what was that movie called?
God,
that,
I forgot.
That's ancient.
Pushpa, hate years. Yes.
Exactly, that's the one. So she was obsessed with Bollywood and music, and she really loved Saif Ali Khan's mum. What was Sharmila Tagore? She was obsessed with her. So yeah, that. And I also really found this Shashi Kapoor guy to be very handsome. To this date, I think he's absolutely handsome.
Yeah.
So yeah, I like that kind of Bollywood. And then Kuch Kuch Hota Hai, Kabhi Khushi Kabhi Gham, Karan Johar's era was beautiful again.
Amazing.
So yeah.
Yeah.
So growing up, we had this family doctor, Dr. Jay Krishan. That was my first ever interaction with a Hindu, Pakistani. And he was very famous, and my mother used to say that even though, like, he doesn't follow the same religion as us, but I don't trust anyone else other than him to treat my kids. And he just has this shifa in his hands, and shifa is a word that you use, like cure in his hands, which is like a blessing from God. So we really, really liked him, respected him. That's the only interaction that I had with Dr. Jay Krishan. Other than that, I remember in KPK, every time we used to be on Motorway, I used to see these sick community either celebrating their festivals, because the time that we used to have our festivals, they used to have their festivals as well. And I used to see them jam-packed, and I kind of was like, hey, what are those people wearing turbans on their hair? That's very exotic for me. I don't know what that is. And then my mom would say it's they have their religious sites in Tarbela, or is it Taxila, somewhere there. So it's like, oh, interesting, because in Pakistan, you don't see people mostly, at least in Islamabad, you don't see people mostly Hindus. It's just Islamabadis, I just say. So that was an exotic experience for me. But yes, in Pakistan as well, they're in a minority. I don't know the struggles that they've had, but I do see stories sometimes in Sindh that definitely there are cases of oppression there. But at the same time, we also have some really well-established people, very successful people and celebrated people. Like, we have designers like Deepak Parwani as well, doing a fantastic job. And doctors like Dr. Jay Krishan. I think a year back or so, we had 2-3 or maybe more civil servants as well, passing a very difficult competitive exam. So it means that it goes to show that we do give them opportunities as well to come on the forefront. But when it comes to minority, then of course, they're in a minority, because after all, it is an Islamic state. So,
and there's also like a huge influence of Punjabi music.
Oh yes, Punjabi music. Sidhu Moosewala, people love him in Pakistan, to the extent that they even have the Sidhu Moosewala posters on their cars, which goes to show that the fandom is real. You know, they're obsessed. And when he passed away, I think he was shot, people were really sad.
Yeah.
And endless statuses on Facebook and Twitter, and he was like a global icon. But one thing I've noticed, at least in Pakistan, when it comes to the Punjabis, is that they have identity crisis in Pakistan. Funnily enough, in India, I don't think they have that sort of identity crisis. They own up their roots, which I think is fantastic. You know, with the rise of these musicians that we have, be it Shub, be it AP Dhillon, or this very recent one who made a movie with Hania Amir as well, Diljit Dosanjh. So they're the ones actually giving people the confidence to own up their roots, you know. I was watching Diljit Dosanjh's video on Instagram where he said that, you know, Punjabi is my mother language, you know. I can't say the same for artists in Pakistan, at least, which is a bit disappointing, because why would you not be confident of your roots, you know? And at the same time, if it's Punjabi ethnicity, why is it that people in Pakistan tend to undermine it or belittle it? Or they always say that, you know, we understand Punjabi, but we can't speak it. And they take great pride in it. Yeah. But honestly, I've never seen any Punjabi from India, the ones that I've interacted with in Denmark or Germany or wherever I've traveled, they never give these statements. You know, they very confidently own up who they are. Yeah. And I think that's fantastic. So when we talk about identity crisis, I think it's a deeply ingrained issue when it comes to the Punjabi community, at least in Pakistan. And I wish to change that. I really wish to change that. And I hope they change it with time. But why do you think, like, you're also in India and you're a Punjabi yourself. So why do you think, like, what could be the reason?
No, I mean, obviously, one reason is that you're a minority. So wherever you're a minority, you somehow end up like taking a second fiddle. It is
in Pakistan, natural. They're a majority, actually.
And, I mean, then I don't know why. Yeah. In fact, that's a question.
To know, like, in Pakistan, yeah,
that's a question
a
for the audience, I guess. Maybe someone feeling.
Maybe in the comment section if you can enlighten us. So
Yeah, someone would, because I mean, our nature is also very loud.
Yeah.
Like, I know even when I'm talking really softly that I'm talking so loudly that
you're known to be pompous as well.
Yeah, I'm constantly asking my flatmate, like, I hope it's okay. Like, I'm not too loud, because that's just like. We're very open, we're very like vocal about our actions and
standard
dance.
Stereotype that people from Delhi are really pompous as well, and that's an assumption linked with Lahoris too.
Yeah,
so they're very loud.
That I know. Karachi with Bombay, and,
Karachi
and
with Bombay.
Lahore with Delhi.
Exactly.
And I remember Lahore Gram School would come to like my school as well for an exchange program, like back when days were good. So yeah, it's very, very similar. But I mean, it's just sad that we don't end up talking about it, or we don't get to talk about it so much. I don't know, maybe it's because we fear it, or maybe we don't realize it. Because even when I'm watching like at Hum TV, my favorite channel. Okay, so, and I love watching all the serials with my mom. Like, I think that is the time where we actually spend good quality. Serial watching, I would say. I think like there is like a lot of similarity there as well. We see whether it comes to like chai or the food or like the way we talk, the way we greet, like I know it's very different. Like when I'm here in Germany, I know that when I go out with friends, it's always like we're paying separately, and there's like an option to pay separately. There's no option to pay separately back home, you know. He's like if you tell them you pay separately, he's like, one of you pay now, then you can do it later. Like the waiter is telling you like that. And it's like, because we know that like there's so much apnapan. So I think like these things are very common between both of us.
Funnily enough, I'll tell you a funny story. So I asked this friend of mine from Delhi to get me these chicken curry kurtas. And I was wearing one of them in Islamabad somewhere at a store. And this lady comes up to me and she's like, where did you get this from? And I said, from Delhi. And she's like, what store is that? And I was like, the capital of India, Delhi. So she's like, oh, okay. That was really funny. And to this date, whenever I wear that kurta, it's just symbolic of that moment that I got to experience. It was very funny.
No, it's like, even though we're so close, it's like so far.
They just think it's so foreign and so alien, the possibility of having something from India, especially in, you know, present 100%. Times, you know. It's just a very alien concept. And I feel like even though we want to be friends deep down, but the fact that some people still think that, you know, being friendly with a Pakistani might mean that we're being disloyal to our country. I don't know where this feeling comes from. But this, again, is very deeply ingrained. You know, it's fine. It makes sense if someone who doesn't have that kind of exposure or that kind of enlightenment to come up with these beliefs or these misconceptions. But for someone who comes from a progressive household, has access to education, exposure as well, and for them to have these repressive thoughts is, I think, quite sad.
Yeah, that is true.
It's very sad, and I think it's disappointing as well, because you have, you know, if you're a global citizen, you've traveled a lot, you should know that you can't just befriend people based on their nationality or what their personal 100%. Beliefs are. You know?
Yeah, it should be based on like their morals and their thoughts. And if it doesn't match yours, it shouldn't. But like, I it's also like so outrageous that I remember when I was looking for houses to stay in Berlin at some point. I was like, I'm interested, like 2-3 of us want to stay together or whatever. And he's like, all of you Indians, no Pakistanis allowed in capital. And I was like my first response to that is I actually don't want to stay in this house anymore, because I don't want to go, like, what if, like, maybe you can say, oh, you're anti-national if you're saying that. But I'm wondering, what if someone would say that on the other side as well? Like, no Indians allowed. That's not cool.
This reminds me of back when we were under the British Raj. And how they'd say Hindus and dogs not allowed. So we're doing the same thing, but in a different, maybe diction. But again, the idea is still the same. And if we're trying to limit our friendships and restrict ourselves just based on our nationality or what our beliefs are, you're actually closing off an opportunity or a door for you to maybe interact with a different perspective, a different mindset that might broaden your thinking.
I mean, it's great that you pointed that out. I think it was Indians and dogs, not Hindus and
dogs. Indians and dogs.
I think, like, colonialism plays such a big role.
Yeah.
And it's awful, because I feel like though they did good for us as well, like, let's just say one thing, like railways, they, like, really shattered our culture. They really shattered our beliefs. They really shattered our ideas with the fact that... in one of the organizations I was working, I was bullied at some point because I come from an urban city and I come from, let's say, an upper middle class household where English is my first language. Yeah. And speaking in Hindi, I'm always a little afraid because I'm not very good at it, I would say. Like, it's not a language that I would converse in professionally.
Yeah.
And I was bullied for it, being like, oh, ew, you come from there and stuff. And I'm like, but like, you come back there and we'll bully you for speaking your language, because we are like, English is more important. And it's just a funny thing. Like, colonialism brings that in you, like, that you find someone who is below you just because of a language.
Exactly. It's that inferiority complex that's so deeply rooted within us. I went to a Catholic Christian school, Jesus and Mary of Convent, and we used to be punished for speaking in a language that's not English. And this is unbelievable. This is just outrageous.
Yeah. And somehow it was cool.
It was cool. Like, yeah. You can't just have a slip of tongue even in a different language. It has to be English.
Yeah, I know. It also took me a long time, because I know, like, I grew up in Calcutta. I mean, I grew up in Delhi, but, like, a lot of my culture comes from Calcutta. Yeah. And my ideal idea of breakfast is baked beans on toast with, like, an English breakfast tea.
Yeah.
And then I come here and then I'm chilling with someone who's like, aloo ke parathe khaoge subah. And I'm like, I don't know how to do that, you know.
Yeah.
But it's also like, I think that I'm too poised, because I'm eating with, like, a fork and knife and I'm having bread and breakfast. I mean, like the food which is not really ours, and look down upon the food which is,
it's just so funny to think that people even link the sort of food we have to a status symbol.
100%.
So in KP, in a standard Pakhtun household, we love meat, right? So anyone who eats dal or lentils, they're like, oh, you're a dal khor, it's just looked down upon that you can't afford to have meat. And so, which is why I never knew how to make dal. And when I came to Berlin, the first person to actually teach me how to cook or to make dal was an Indian friend of mine from Jammu. And she taught me how to make dal. And growing up, I used to hate peas. Mm. And she made this kaju katli sabzi with peas in it. And it was delicious.
Yeah.
That was the best thing ever. And I think I started having vegetables and dals after moving to Berlin, which is just wow. No, thanks also, to my Indian friends.
Yeah. I also learned from a Pakistani friend how to make aloo ka paratha. Like, because I didn't know that, like, you can take one and then you can put aloo on it and then you make another one and you put on top of it, and that becomes, like, such a big thing.
Yeah.
And obviously doodh patti, and that's what he used to make. And I was like, oh, that's how we're supposed to make. Oh my, like, God, it's the best thing. I feel like
doodh patti is a Pakistani thing, but masala chai is an Indian thing.
Yeah, doodh patti is a Pakistani
thing. And these Indian friends of mine, they always get these masala chais from back home that their mothers prepare with cardamom and cinnamon crushed together, and it tastes delicious.
It is.
It's so aromatic and so therapeutic.
Doodh pati makes me gassy.
Doodh pati, it
does. Yeah.
Can't comment on that. Yeah.
But I mean, I also want to understand what is like the idea of women and the expectations of women in your society.
Mm-hmm. So when you say society, do you mean like Pakistan, or do you mean like Khyber Pakhtunkhwa?
Yeah, generally like Pakistan and the culture that you come from, I'd say.
So in Pakistan, I think we've had our fair share of, like, starting off with media at least. 20 years back, I don't think my parents would be comfortable having me, you know, giving a podcast interview with my face on. At least if my parents were progressive enough, they'd be completely fine with it. But then they'd say, oh, what about your uncles? And they wouldn't be comfortable with this, you know. So with time, I think we're okay with women coming on the forefront. I mean, Pakistan is one of the first Muslim countries to have a female prime minister, elected prime minister, Benazir Bhutto Shahid. Yeah. So that, again, it speaks volumes. And I think with times, if you're changing for better, you're evolving, it goes to show that, you know, you're not stagnant and you're open to change. So I think similarly in Pakistan as well, we're seeing women coming on the forefront, be it in media, movies. Hania Amir made a movie with Diljit Dosanjh. Diljit Dosanjh. We have Mahira Khan. These are just celebrities. 20, 30 years ago, this was a taboo.
Yeah.
It was looked down upon. That, you know, if she's in movies or if she's singing, she must come from a morally compromised family, you know. But now it's just accepted as art, and which I think is fantastic. And I think when you look at how progressive a country is or how open they are to empower women, just look at the representation that they have in media or in art. Because, of course, there's traditional professions that they have, or women should be a doctor. Even lawyers look down upon because they're like, oh, you know, she's going to interact with men and she's going to have to go to courts and kacheris. And, you know, that's not an ideal profession for a delicate, pristine woman. But now I think we're really working on women empowerment, feminism. We've had feminist movements as well, the Aurat March. But the sad thing is, because of the influence of Mullahism, these women empowerment movements or feminist movements are always linked with misandry. You know, so they think that, okay, just because she wants to have a right to express herself or to be vocal, it must mean that, you know, she is a vulgar woman, which is absolutely absurd. And this has got nothing to do with religion, because Islam itself empowers women. You know, we've had Khadija Razila Talan, who was Prophet's wife. She was a businesswoman, you know. Aisha Razila Talan, in the Battle of Jamal or Camel, she was the one who rode camels and actually was on the forefront for that battle as well. So which goes to show that religion isn't a barrier here. It's Mullahism that's misinterpreting religion for their control, you know, because in every country, or in the past that we've seen, if you study European history, you'd see that the clergy always had an influence on the way the system worked within their country.
Yeah.
You know, so if they don't misinterpret Islam or, you know, the way we believe, their role in our country or society would just be redundant. So they constantly misinterpret what a feminist movement means, what an Aurat March could mean. And
isn't that patriarchy in general?
Yes.
Like the idea
is patriarchy because they want to suppress women.
I think like generally the idea of patriarchy is it's not to like bring men up, but like women down.
Exactly.
To make yourself better.
Exactly.
And I mean, we can now jump into the segment about men, which we've always wanted to talk about, I guess. Like, but I really want to understand, because I talk to so many women.
Yeah.
And for obviously reasons. And I just feel like everyone always has like this weird idea about not getting the perfect man. And like they having to compromise their ideologies.
Yeah.
So I'm always confused about it, to be honest. Because I'm like, what I'm thinking, is that right? Or am I too out there to the left?
Mm-hmm.
Or am I like too much?
Yeah.
You know, these thoughts come up and
I feel like you'll never be too much for the right person.
No.
Never. And I know it sounds very cliche, but it's actually the truth. Yeah. And I would really, really ask women or whoever's watching the show.
Yeah.
I mean, by now they should know this already, because with all the women empowerment and, you know, women are very self-sufficient.
Yeah, they are.
They're very self-sufficient, you know. in present times at least. And I know it comes from a place of privilege as well, but if you have that kind of privilege and you have that kind of opportunity to earn for yourself, to educate yourself, then I think you should have the confidence to make decisions for yourself as well. And nothing good ever comes out of just settling for someone, you know, just because you're lonely or you're bored. No, I strongly advocate against this.
I feel like we're true, strong, independent women, which is frowned upon quite often as well.
It intimidates men, you know?
100%.
So it intimidates them. Yeah.
I have seen that.
And they have the savior mindset as well, that, you know, we want a weak woman, a very submissive woman that we can control, you know, like a puppet.
Yeah.
So if you question them, that's when their ego gets bruised.
I mean, I just want to give a disclaimer that we're not talking about all men.
Of course.
But we're just talking about like a general set of people that we've met. Because there are good men out there as well. I don't know. But
In my case, my family or my relatives are always like, you know, you're very picky. It's going to be very hard for you to find someone your ideal
type. But I want to understand, like, in very short, what is love for you?
I think love is very selfless.
Selfless. Okay.
Where you don't think about, you know, it's not transactional. Like, what can you do for me in order for me to give something back to you? You know, you just want to give something to the person.
But isn't that what relationships have become today?
I mean, I've never had a relationship, so.
Yeah, that's true. But like, I mean, when you hear it, that's what it's become, right? Like, if you don't do something for someone, why should someone do it for you?
Yeah.
Right?
Selfish.
Yeah, I mean, selfish is not a bad word.
Is it not?
Like, no, not really. I mean, I think it's bad to say that because, like, if I can't watch out for myself, how do you expect me to watch out for someone else? Like, this idea, I think the idea of being selfless in love is redundant. At least that's my understanding. Yeah. Because I feel like, number one, if I'm giving, then I'm giving. I don't know if I'm getting, because for me, the idea is giving, right? Yeah. And then I'm losing myself out. And if I can't take a stand for myself, then I can't even be loyal to the person, because technically I'm cheating on them because I'm not giving them who I am. I'm just giving them an idea of who they would want me to be, which I'm not.
Sometimes you can also come off as a doormat.
Yeah.
And people want to take advantage of you then. Yeah. Because they're like, okay, she's so selfless and, you know, we can just do whatever we want.
Yeah.
So then maybe you have to be selfish.
As a Pakistani, you also want to understand, like, you were very pro Imran Khan.
Yes.
And why is that? What is it that the Pakistanis see in Imran Khan?
Pakistanis see a spine in him.
Okay.
You know, the spine to call out bullshit, simply put. You know, without getting into the nitty-gritties of it, I think Imran Khan is one of the very few leaders who can call out America's unnecessary involvement. We are not willing to be America's scapegoat, precisely. That, I think, is fantastic for a country like Pakistan to have a selfless leader. Again, selfless. When I say selfless, it's because he could have lived a very comfortable life in the UK. He was married to Jemima Goldsmith. Mm-hmm. Financially very strong, he had two sons, he didn't have to get involved in, you know, politics of Pakistan, dirty politics of Pakistan, where we have generations ruling us, you know. For someone who's an outsider with no hereditary links to politics to make a mark for himself is remarkable. Why did he do that? Because he genuinely wanted, especially the youth for Pakistan, to speak up for themselves. And then with the recent Pakistan-India escalation as well.
Yeah, I think media's role in that was like pretty awful. Like,
from India's side?
From both sides.
From India's side, let me say that.
Like, no, from both sides.
Can you just name an Arnab Goswami that Pakistan has?
I didn't even have to name an Arnab Goswami that Pakistan has. There is no way you can tell me that there was like no miscommunication from like Pakistan's media.
But the thing is, the sensationalism on our end was nothing compared
That's also because you don't have that platform to be that sensational.
Platform, we have crazy good news channels.
I'm not saying you don't.
So what
do you mean
by platform?
But obviously you can't compare it to the size that India has for obvious reasons.
No, it has got nothing to do with size. It has got to do with clowns that are being broadcasted
on both sides
at a time where, you know, anything can happen. Two nuclear states at war and you're trying to push them to further fight and murder and kill each other and bomb each other. Like, why would you do that?
Yeah,
that's
but
jingoism. Like, at one point, one of those Indian journalists, he's like, we want Asim Munir's head on a spear. And I was like, what?
This is 21st century where like digital warfare. But you also saw how your
defense minister was like, Twitter pe dekh lo. What was going on?
Like, what did he expect, that people are going to come on camels and horses with spears in their hands and they're going to take us in?
Yeah, but it worked both ways. You can't just keep
blaming. No, I'm not saying we're completely like 100% we're crystal clear. It's not that.
But I think that time we also became a lot closer to each other culturally and socially with all the memes that were coming up. And I think it was
the really memes were crazy.
Oh my the god, memes, I absolute love
banter,
them.
Absolute
the
banter.
Reels are crazy. It's like, oh my god, mummy, what are you doing? There's no hum TV left for us
that
anymore.
That was really cute. That
yeah,
really
I, cute. Though I thought that was like really aggressive, like to just ban the channels and the actors.
Yeah.
It didn't make sense to me. I mean, I'm like, okay, you can do the war. Focus on that a little bit more than focusing on this.
Yeah.
But like, they were really funny. What's my outfit? How's my outfit for the war and stuff?
Interestingly enough, I was speaking to some of my Indian friends. And they were like, you know what? We think it's a PR stunt.
What?
PR stunt in a sense that Pakistan wants its army to come in good books and for people to celebrate them. Like, oh, Pakistan army, the saviors. And, you know, they're the ones to protect us. And then on India's forefront, they wanted to put Modi in a good limelight. That, oh, because I think Modi was on his election campaign at that point, if I'm not mistaken, or something.
At the war, no?
Not at the war, but it was to win mandate for him, to make him seem as a leader or as a populist leader. Okay. So I was like, okay, makes sense. Yeah. And that's the same narrative that my Pakistani friends had as well. They're like, okay, it actually makes sense that maybe it was a PR stunt from both countries that they... I mean, I don't know the inside is, but we can only assume.
Okay.
But this is what we discussed as well, and it kind of makes sense. I mean, that's a conspiracy theory that I can maybe fall for.
That's
an interesting take.
Yeah,
instance where you just said that we're in KP in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, and I was like, whoa, what?
Yeah,
because usually Indians, they say, oh, Pathans, you know, Pathans is a title given to us by Indians and British. We identify as Pakhtun and Pashtuns, not Pathans. So when we say, like, I'm from Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, I'll say I'm a Pakhtana. I wouldn't say I'm a Pathan.
Okay.
But the fact that you knew this, and when you said, like, oh, we're in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, I was like, girl, what? Like, you really know what's going on.
No, obviously, I like Pakistan.
Yeah.
I mean, like every other country. I don't hate a country. I mean, I do hate one. But, like, I hate the leaders of a lot of countries.
Is it the same one that we mutually hate?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. But I
mean... Hint, guys.
But I mean, like, I don't hate countries. You have to hate leaders, right? Because like, people make a country.
Yeah.
It's very unfortunate that when you elect leaders, you don't always elect them for the worst, right? You kind of elect them for the better.
Yeah.
But like, what they do is not in your hands.
Yeah.
So and when you say you hate a country, then you kind of end up hating the citizens of those countries. And like we discussed earlier in this podcast, that it's not nice to like hate people based off their nationality.
Yes.
Yeah.
That, and I think it should never be okay to celebrate death.
No, never.
On either side.
Ever.
Never, you know, because your loyalties are going to stay with your country, and naturally so, understandably so. My loyalties are going to stay with my country, and understandably so, right? But that being said, I am never going to celebrate Indians dying on the other end.
Absolutely.
You know, being massacred
either
or butchered.
Way.
I would never be okay with that. And anyone celebrating that is a despicable person, is a horrible person.
That has nothing to do, I
and
think.
And sadly, on Twitter, I did see some tweets circulating where people were actually celebrating people dying.
It's insane.
It's sad.
It's sad. That, I mean, that is like end of
and
humanity.
I think they need help. End of humanity, and I think they need help. They really need help.
I think I want to now jump to this point of understanding mental health issues that a lot of us are facing, especially when we're staying away from our family and the culture that we live in is very different than the culture that we have.
Yeah.
And from the smallest thing like the food to like big things like understanding cultural differences and nuances, I think it really plays like a big role.
Yeah.
So I want to understand, how did that work out for you?
So growing up, I was very pampered to the point that where I didn't even know how to hold a spoon and to like to stir a pot, my hand would get tired. So when the first time I was making dal and I was actually making that third kind, stirring the pan or whatever, my hand started hurting. So I actually had to hold it and then stir it. So that's a sort of protected and pampered environment I've lived in. But when I came to Berlin, every little thing used to irritate me and annoy me. And I used to get anxiety, like, oh my God, I'm panicking and every little thing. And the one thing that really calmed me down was journaling. I used to journal a lot. Like, what are my trigger points? How do I work on that? You know, and planning my day. That calmed my anxiety. And then building a relationship with God and being a very spiritual person. I wouldn't say a very spiritual person, but at least trying to understand what God is, because I'm a believer.
Mm-hmm.
And meditating helped a lot. And prayer in itself is a form of meditation.
Yeah.
So I became regular with that. And that's how my mental health improved a lot as well. Watching comedy shows, spending time in nature was an excellent addition to improving my mental health. And just generally staying away from negative people or anything that can disrupt my my mental peace.
But I think, like, when we come here, we don't understand that there are lots of small things, like, let's say, weather and the regular people that you hang out with and the conversations that you have, that also takes, like, a huge mental toll on you. And, I mean, it can also be in a positive way, but a lot in a negative way, because, like, Germany is a place where almost 9 to 10 months of a year it's winter, which is not a climate where we come from, because we're a tropical country, and we come here with, like, a lot of aspirations, but, like, we forget that these things matter so much that they actually drain you to a point that the reason why you're coming here is, like, it's not fulfilled.
Yeah,
it's not fulfilled. And I feel like there are very few conversations around it as well, because they just feel like... I was just seeing a reel of one of these influencers who says that she's in London right now and she's lived there for a few years, and people just keep texting her at all given points of time, oh my God, you're living, like, the dream life, and you're living this. And not like she chose to come out, but it is so important to understand that it's not a luxury life, but, like, a life of survival here. And it's really troublesome.
Mm-hmm. Well, comparing the weather, firstly, it was horrible in Denmark because it's always so gloomy. I love Denmark, but it's so gloomy and dark. So compared to that, Berlin is much better.
Mm.
Yeah. So I don't think the weather here took a toll on me or depressed me as much as it did in Denmark. But I think the one thing that really kept me going in Denmark was the fact that I was living with my family there, so I could manage it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This loneliness really kicks into you. Like,
the lonely pandemic that we had.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Like, I was also here in pandemic, but
yeah.
I was grateful that I was living with friends. So,
yeah.
Like, a little bit I was saved mentally.
I had a moment during COVID where I just didn't know what to do. And at 2 a.m., I was like, what do? I can't even call my parents because it's such an ungodly hour. What do? I just, in my Crocs, I just opened the door. And it was snowing at that point. And I just went out. I'm like, I can't breathe. I feel like the walls in my room is eating me up. I have to go out. And I just kept staring at the sky. And I was like, God, I know you're with me. And you're the only one I have right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kept chanting this over and over again. And it was a very scary moment in my
this
life.
This loneliness.
Very loneliness, sheer loneliness,
and
helplessness at that point as well.
Yeah.
It was very scary.
Yeah, I think, and, like, circling back to when we were talking about men, that I think a lot of us are in relationships because of loneliness, because loneliness kills. Like, it really does. So, like, just the idea of being with somebody to not get yourself killed, I think
which is why people are in so many dead-end relationships, just because they fear staying alone.
But it's scary as well, right? I'm not saying, like, you should stay alone, but I think staying alone and loneliness are, like, two
different things.
Yeah, and, like, I stay alone.
Yeah.
And there are lots of times where I'm just like, I'm okay. I also need my own space while I live alone.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I understand that. But, like, this idea of loneliness, this thing inside you that sinks, and it makes you feel like you just don't belong in this world anymore.
Yeah.
I think that's just so hard to fight.
Yeah.
And it happens a lot when you're, like, away from family, away from friends. And no matter how hard you try, it's just so difficult to get out of it.
Yeah, which is why I think it's so important for anyone to be at peace with themselves and enjoy their company. Because then they can differentiate, like, okay, what is this person adding to my life? You know, what's their value added element into my life? So if you're never satisfied with yourself, if you can't stay still with your thoughts, then you just jump at any opportunity or any person that shows you the slightest bit of affection. So which is why I would really encourage women or whoever's watching this show to actually hold a standard for yourself, and no matter what happens, never compromise on that.
Mm.
being a woman, a South Asian woman, there's always a pressure on us, you know, the biological clock, or, you know, with age, you're becoming more stiff and more rigid in your ways, and no man's ever going to like you. Well, no man has to. The right one will true. When the time comes, you know, but why should I settle for someone who's not even meeting me halfway there, you know?
Yeah, but that's, I think the idea is also, again, a reel that I saw where it was just so okay for them to say that everything is fine as long as the girl is compromised.
Exactly. And have you noticed that with every failed marriage, they're always linking it with, you know, oh, the woman was too progressive and she was too bold for the guy, and which is why the marriage didn't work.
Oh my
like
God,
why
always.
Is the onus always placed on a woman and never on a man? This is just so unfair.
Yeah.
Especially in South Asian communities. Yeah. And it's really sad how, you know, certain women, when they come from families where their parents are not supportive enough, and they're like, okay, now that's your home, and no matter what happens, you're gonna stay there.
That
and they
is the
take
problem.
All sorts of abuse, be it
oh
emotional
God.
Abuse, physical abuse, and also the fact that they're not capable enough to earn a living for themselves. You know, they're not financially stable or independent, and which is why they take all sorts of rubbish from them.
Absolutely. I was literally having this conversation yesterday with someone where they're just saying that it's a tradition. It is a tradition, and it just
stops there. Traditions
are
always outdated. They're not meant
for... It's okay to have traditions, but you have to understand that some things have to like grow with time, right?
Yeah.
Like your generations, I'm sure that your parents weren't allowed something that you are allowed. So like they've evolved, right?
Yeah.
But like this idea that it is a tradition and you can't fight tradition, it's crazy. And also the like they were saying ke, if there is a man and a woman who are married and then they have kids, and there is something that is celebrated in the woman's house, so it's okay if the woman celebrates it, but if it's not celebrated in the man's house, the kids are not going to celebrate it. And I'm like, but who gives them the right that what the man is doing and man's family is doing is what the kid needs to seek in?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't understand from where this concept comes. And then if you say that no, then they start off with tradition is like this and religion is like that, and I'm like, you gotta grow out of it, man.
You really have to. And with, you know, even if a woman's working, she's a working lady, she has a job, she's still expected to manage the household.
Oh my God,
you know, like, okay, a man is just restricted to doing his job, his business, whatever, and then everything has to be plated or presented to him in a platter. He's not expected to do anything in the household. It's a woman's job. So she has to do her job outside, then she has to come to her home, manage everything there, and then be a perfect bahu or a perfect whatever. And this just doesn't sit well with me.
Yeah, I don't understand like this, but the concept of paraya dhan and like just giving a woman away or giving the girl child away. You're not giving anybody away, man. Like you just have to, like, you have to understand that there are some concepts which are too outdated. And like, first of all, you just need to ask the girl, like, does she want to be given away? Like, is that an idea that she goes with? It's absolutely okay if she goes with that idea. Like, there's nothing wrong.
Yeah.
But like, I think people don't even understand that the concept of feminism is not that we're fighting men.
It's to be able to choose for yourself.
It's
like
to be
choice.
Able to give the opportunity to a woman to decide what she wants to do. Because if I want to get married and I just want to sit at home and I want to like take care of the house while the husband is like the bread earner, it should be okay. I'm not frowning upon that.
Yeah.
But I'm also not frowning upon the fact that if there is someone out there who's earning equally, if not more, than her partner and comes back home and both of them have decided, or she's at least saying that we need to split our chores, there's absolutely nothing wrong in that as well.
Yeah.
Like, there is nothing which is anybody's duty.
And this obligation as well, that, you know, if you're 25, then you're obligated to get married. You have to get married. Well, have you asked the girl, does she want to get married? And who has set these age limitations anyway? Who has set them? You
know, it's just
maybe
society.
She never wants to get married. You know, I sometimes think of the possibility I might never want to get married.
My God.
I'm just thinking I might never want to.
Yeah.
And does that mean I failed as a woman?
Apparently.
I think we should also work on this notion, if women are supposed to get married by 25, at least in South Asian cultures, you know, the good daughter, good bahu, whatever, then we should also normalize women not ever wanting to get married. Why
Absolutely.
Is that not okay?
No, these are the conversations
that
we want to have, which
is
why we are here on the podcast.
Yeah.
Because it's very necessary. I feel like a lot of the conversations that I have with my friends, and I think I'm saying this for the first time on my podcast as well, that a lot of conversations that I've had with friends, a lot of conversations that I've had professionally being a journalist, because you meet all kinds of people, they have conversations which are just remained till that conversation, and then they don't spur into a dialogue.
Yeah.
And if they don't spur into a dialogue, then they can't hope for change.
Yeah.
They can't hope for difference. They yeah. can't hope for the fact that they want it to, they want it to be different.
Yeah.
If it's just between me and them, and mm-hmm. that conversation just ends there. Yeah.
And there's so much back and forth, early marriage, late, always oscillating in between.
Yeah.
Where's the possibility of someone never wanting to get married? Why is that not in the picture?
Absolutely, there
you
should
know?
Be.
No one questions this. You know, it's either early marriage or late marriage. What about someone who never wants to get married? What about them? All of a sudden, they're outcasts, you know, like yeah. iconoclasts maybe.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's crazy because if a man is never married, he's probably still a stud and can go around with like yeah. a 20-year-old. If
or he's
50.
A chronic bachelor, you know.
Yeah. yeah. And if it's a woman, then they're like, oh, devil.
Devil, or maybe she's too uptight or demanding, yeah. you know. She's too picky.
Yeah.
And also this fear that they instill within us that, you know, if you're so picky and, you know, you'll just, at the end of the day, you'll just marry someone just for the heck of it. Why yeah. is that? Is marriage so important that I'll just compromise what my beliefs and my wishes are just to settle down with anybody?
Yeah.
Like, that's... I think we should really be comfortable
yeah.
living with ourselves, you know? Yeah. I don't think a man, like, yes, having a partner is good mm. because you have a companion for life.
Yeah.
But I'd rather take my time finding the right person for myself yeah. than ending up hastily
yeah.
rushing into something and then regretting it.
I heard somewhere at a place that relationships and love should be peace. Like the only conflict that you're having in your life should be your career
yeah.
and not your partner, not your love, not your home.
Mm-hmm.
And when I heard that, like that was so strong, such strong words said so easily, because it made me realize that even if I'm having banter that you have in every relationship in your life, but I want that when that person is there with me, when the person is around me, they're giving me peace. They're giving me that when tomorrow is going to be a bad day, I know that you're going to be there for mm-hmm. me. And I think that's just so hard to find. And when that happened, I was like, cut mm-hmm. this person out, cut that person out, cut yeah. that person out. Because there's no belonging.
Yeah.
So... yeah, that's, I think.
I feel like everyone's at a war within.
Yeah.
Everyone. And how do you, like, I feel like to be with someone, you have to be a therapist as well. Understand how they were raised and what sort of household what they raised in. What are their childhood traumas? And no one's really ever vulnerable about this, yeah. you know, because no one really wants to shed light on what their insecurities are,
mm-hmm.
which is why it's so hard for someone to understand where the other person's coming from, mm-hmm. right? Because you don't know their challenges.
Absolutely.
You don't know what holds them back.
Yeah.
So if we're not confident in being vulnerable, if we're not mm. okay with being vulnerable and talking about our insecurities, I don't think we can ever have long-lasting relationships, yeah. be it platonic, romantic, or any sort of relationship.
No. I think it's really good because we touched upon so many points in this podcast, in this episode, that are dialogues that just remain at like a bar when you're drunk or when you're meeting
or having schnache somewhere at a...
exactly. So I'm really glad that we had that, but now we're coming to an end. So I have this question which I ask all my guests, that since you've gone beyond the border and you're on this podcast, what is the advice you'd like to give to someone who'd want to go beyond border in any aspect?
Have an open mind.
Mm-hmm.
Don't make an opinion about someone just because of what you've read or what you've been, let's say, brainwashed into believing. Have your own beliefs, have your own experiences. You know, from the village that I come from, the people who work for us, they're like, oh, you know, Indians and they're enemies. And I had a friend who had a password, I hate India.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, how can you say you hate India? You've never interacted with them. You don't know any Indian just because of whatever the media shows you.
Yeah.
That's not okay, you know? So I would really recommend and suggest that when you go beyond borders, go with an open mind. Not with any prejudices, not with whatever the media is telling you. Have your own opinions, have your own experiences. Just because you've had one bad experience with a Pakistani or Indian or whoever does not mean that you're going to blame the entire ethnicity yeah. or the entire nationality. You know, be okay with giving them chances, interact as much as you can, and then make an informed decision for yourself. An understanding of what.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I am so grateful that we had this conversation and we're out there with a lot of cultural and social. And a bit of political discussions and dialogues, and I hope more people get inspired by you to start an open dialogue. And yeah, I hope you had a good time.
Thank you for having me. I had an amazing time. I'd just like to add that I'm not an expert on culture or strategic or defense studies. Just take this as a conversation you might want to eavesdrop in a coffee shop or somewhere. And go easy on us.
Yay, we're done. Thank you so much for staying until the end. To help us continue these conversations, please subscribe on YouTube and like and follow on Instagram and Spotify.